things get a little bit grim. But this is especially heinous.
Did you tell the police that she was murdered, May?
Nope.
Witchy ghost stuff.
Ah!
That made me scared.
A spooky girl amateur hour.
Close. It's not as close. It's a little further away. It's on the outskirts of my heart. It's like more in the bottom of my lungs.
That's a good place for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah. I think mine's like in the pit of my stomach.
Okay.
Like, you know, like down here. It's not like here.
Like you feel it in the diaphragm.
Yeah, not in like the tear place, which is like right here.
Right, in the throat. Speaking of, I have a lump.
What?
Right here. It's really sore. It's about the size of a grape.
Is it thyroid? Or not thyroid, that's your lymph node.
Is it? I don't know. This one's not swollen. This one is fine. This one is swollen. It's right here. You can. Yeah. It feels like a grape.
Yeah, it's like a drainage gland.
Is it?
Mm-hmm. If you have any like thieves oil, you could rub it on it. Lemon oil.
I have lemon oil.
Yeah.
I'll put lemon oil on it. I strangely don't have thieves, ever.
I never have thieves.
Yeah. That's because I steal your thieves.
No, that could be it. Well, hi.
Hi. What a lovely conversation about essential oils.
You know, we're just driving right in here.
This is what we're here for. This is what we do. Welcome to A Little Bit Grim, a podcast.
Yeah, where we talk at you. You don't get to say anything because we're the ones that are talking.
You're more than welcome.
Join the conversation.
Yeah, say stuff. We just can't reply. But what you can do is you can go comment on the Facebook page about it.
100%.
And then we can reply there.
Yeah. Highly recommend. Facebook page is a blast.
Plug in the social medias at the beginning of the episode.
Ooh, switching it up.
We're just topsy-turvy today.
Oh, man.
Seeing, I think we're trying a new thing.
Uh-huh.
Where, like, we talk about our bright, shiny moments.
Uh-huh.
And because, you know, sometimes things are just a little bit grim and you need them to be a little bit good.
Yes.
So, do you have a bright, shiny?
Oh, are we doing them now or at the end?
Do you want to do it? I think I need one right now.
Okay.
A little bit.
Yeah.
Before we start with the really terrible.
I'm moving this weekend. My house. I realized yesterday that the only time I've ever seen my new house is when we walked it for like the first showing.
Oh wow.
And Ryan has been there to do like inspections and stuff, so he's like gotten time to like be in the house and I haven't.
Yeah.
So I'm very excited. I'm supposed to get keys tomorrow night and I just want to go and like be by myself in my house for a minute and just like
absorb it.
Mm-hmm. So that's my bright shiny.
Oh my gosh, I love that.
Yeah. What's yours?
I didn't think this through. We should have put it at the end of the episode. I had a particularly good Americano coffee this morning.
Oh, yeah. From the Starbs?
Yeah, the Starbs. Starby. Starby, baby.
I love that for you.
Thank you.
Did it keep you energized?
It did. It's gotten me to right now, which is 2:08 p.m. So, yes. Very energized.
I'm happy. That's amazing.
Just a particularly good coffee.
You know, and that is just what a bright shiny is. It is just a moment in your day that is just lovely and warm and cozy. Like, it doesn't have to be like you conquered a thing. You, like, made the world a better place. It can be a cup of coffee.
Yeah. Sometimes that's all it is a cup of coffee.
Yeah. And we would love you to tag us in your bright shinies.
Please.
Life can get really dark, and as two people who are very fascinated by dark things, when life gets dark personally, we need the bright shinies, and we need you guys to share your bright shinies with us.
Let us live vicariously through your bright shinies.
Yes, please.
So, with that being said, let's talk about something really, really terrible.
Yay.
Do you want to?
At least it's one of our favorite, rounds. Like, yes. Disasters always gets us going.
Yeah, I love disasters and paranormal, and they come back to back.
Yeah.
So I'm very excited about it. And this one in particular, because this is a particular type of disaster that I generally have no interest in, but boy, did I get interested.
Ooh, I love this.
Because I'm about to tell you about the Bhopal gas disaster.
Ooh.
What is considered the world's worst industrial catastrophe.
Shit, man.
32 tons of deadly chemical gases leaked into the city of Bhopal, India on December 3rd, 1984. An estimated 9,000 people died immediately from the invisible airborne poison, and the final death toll over the ensuing weeks have been estimated at over 20,000.
Oh my God.
And hundreds of thousands of residents suffered permanent injuries. Today, the Union Carbide plant, the site of the disaster, remains a toxic waste site contaminating the groundwater in Bhopal. So, it's also called the Bhopal gas tragedy, and it was a gas leak on the night of the 2nd of December to the 3rd of December at the UCIL pesticide plant in the Madhya Pradesh, India province. Over 500,000 people were immediately exposed to methyl isocyanate gas. It's a highly toxic substance that made its way into and around small towns located near the plant. So the UCIL factory was built in 1969 to produce pesticide 7, which is like the brand name of this particular methyl isocyanate. The production plant was added to the UCIL site in 1979. And the chemical process employed in the plant had methylamine reacting with phosgene to form this particular gas. So there were two gases that were being like scientifically combined to create this kind of, pesticide. Which was then reacted into the final form of the product, Carbaryl. Another manufacturer, Bayer, also used this MIC intermediate process at the chemical plant once owned by UCC at the Institute of West Virginia in the United States. After the plant was built, other manufacturers, including Bayer, produced Carbaryl without MIC, though at a greater manufacturing cost. So they found a way to make it in a safer fashion.
It costs more money.
It just costs a lot more to do so. The route differed from the MIC-free routes used elsewhere, in which the same raw materials combined in a different manufacturing order with a different kind of gas, phosgene. I got very scientific into
this. I can see that.
That would react first and then make it like a less toxic gas before it reached its final form.
Okay.
So there were ways like around the production of this. In 1976, two local trade unions complained of pollution within the plant.
1996?
In 1976.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I was like, wait a second.
We jumped.
That's
we
behind. Jumped. Okay, 76. Got
it. In 1981, a worker was accidentally splashed with phosgene as he was carrying out a maintenance job at the plant's pipes. In a panic, he removed his gas mask and inhaled a large amount of toxic phosgene gas, leading to his death 72 hours later.
Oh my God.
Following these events, journalist Rajkumar Kaswani began investigating and published his findings in Bhopal's local paper, Rapat, in which he urged, quote, "Wake up, people of Bhopal, you are on the edge of a volcano."
Yikes.
In January 1982, a phosgene leak exposed 24 workers, all of whom were admitted to a hospital. None of the workers had been ordered to wear protective equipment.
PPE, y'all.
No, there was no PPE. I have a note at the end of this paragraph that was like, "Tailored, be pissed." 1 month later, in February 1982, an MIC leak affected 18 workers. And then in August of 1982, a chemical engineer came into contact with the liquid form, resulting in burns over 30% of his body.
Oh my God.
In October 1982, there was another leak. In attempting to stop the leak, the MIC supervisor suffered severe chemical burns and two other workers were severely exposed to the gases. During 1983 and 1984, there were leaks of MIC, chlorine, monomethylene, phosgene, and carbon tetrachloride, sometimes in combination.
What were they doing to try to stop all these leaks, though?
Well,
okay, you're gonna tell me.
In late October 1984, tank E610, this is 2 months before the disaster.
Okay.
Tank E10 lost the ability to effectively contain most of its nitrogen gas pressure, which meant that the liquid MIC contained within could not be pumped out. At the time of this failure, tank E610 contained 42 tons of liquid MIC. Shortly after this failure, MIC production was halted at the Bhopal facility and parts of the plants were shut down for maintenance. Maintenance included the shutdown of the plant's flare tower so the corroded pipe could be repaired. With the flare tower still out of service, production of carburel resumed in late November. Using MIC stored in the two tanks that were still in service, an attempt to reestablish pressure in tank E610 on the 1st of December failed. So the 42 tons of liquid MIC contained within could still not be pumped out.
Okay.
So it was just sitting in there for 2 months. They couldn't do anything about it. They tried to repair the pipe. Nothing happened. They've had nothing but leaks and problems leading up to this point, and they still have not done any real work to try to fix the problem or make sure that the workers at the plant are safe, because the rest of the plant is still fully operating.
Okay.
So.
This is not good.
No, it's not good. By early December 1984, most of the plant's MIC-related safety systems were malfunctioning, and many valves and lines were in poor condition. In addition, several vent gas scrubbers had been out of service, as well as the steam boiler that was intended to clean the pipes. During the late evening hours of December 2nd, 1984, water was believed to have entered a side pipe and went into tank E610 while trying to unclog it, which contained the 42 tons of MIC that had been there since 2 freaking months ago. The introduction of water into the tank subsequently resulted in a runaway exothermic reaction, which is heat.
Okay.
Which was accelerated by contaminants, high ambient temperatures, and various other factors, such as the presence of iron from corroding non-stainless steel pipelines. The pressure in E610, although initially nominal at 2 psi, reached 10 psi by 11 p.m. So the pressure in there, like, quadrupled. Two different senior refinery employees assumed the rating was instrumentation malfunction.
Oh my God, no! I know.
And by 11:30 p.m., workers in the MIC area were feeling the effects of a minor exposure to MIC gas. They began to look for a leak. One was found by 11:45 and reported to the MIC supervisor on duty at the time. The decision was made to address the problem after a 12:15 a.m. tea break.
Stop.
Swear. So 30 minutes, they decided, well, we'll talk about it after tea, which was 30 minutes later. In the meantime, employees were instructed to continue looking for leaks. The incident was discussed by MIC area employees during the break. And the 5 minutes after the tea break, which ended at 12:40 a.m., the reaction in tank E610 reached a critical state at an alarming speed. Temperatures in the tank were off the scale, maxed out beyond the 77-degree Fahrenheit that the tank could measure, and the pressure in the tank was indicated at 40 psi.
That's a tire.
That's a tire. That is a tire. You're so smart.
Oh, thanks.
One employee witnessed a concrete slab over tank E610 crack as the emergency relief valve burst open and pressure in the tank continued to increase to 55 psi. This despite the fact that the atmospheric venting of toxic MIC gas had already begun. Direct atmospheric venting should have been prevented or at least partially mitigated by at least 3 safety devices, none of which functioned. They were not in use or insufficiently sized or otherwise rendered inoperable.
Wow. Oh my God.
Oh my God, indeed. A UCIL employee triggered the plant's alarm system at 12:50 a.m. as a concentration of gas in and around the plant became difficult to tolerate. Activation of the system triggered 2 siren alarms, one that sounded inside the plant itself and a second directed to the exterior, which would alert the public in the city of Bhopal. The 2 siren systems had been decoupled from one another 2 years prior in 1982.
Why?
So that it was possible, there's no reasoning, it was possible to leave the factory warning siren on while turning off the public one. And that is exactly what they did.
I don't understand.
The public siren briefly sounded at 12:50 a.m. and was quickly turned off as per company procedure, meant to avoid alarming the public around the factory over tiny leaks. Workers, meanwhile, evacuated the plant and traveled upwind. So, Bhopal Superintendent of Police was informed by telephone by the town inspector that residents of the neighborhood of Chola, about 2 kilometers away from the plant, were fleeing a gas leak at approximately 1 a.m. Calls to the plant by police began at 1:25 and 2:10 a.m. and gave us the plant was like, everything's fine. everything's fine.
The plant was?
Yeah, the plant said, everything is fine. And then at 2:10, when they called the second time, they said, we don't know what's happened, sir. With the lack of untimely information exchange between the plant and the police, the city's Hamidia Hospital was first told that the gas leak was suspected to be ammonia and then phosgene.
Okay.
Finally, they received an updated report that it was MIC, which the hospital staff had never heard of and had no antidote for, nor did they receive any immediate information about it. So anybody experiencing symptoms couldn't even be treated because the hospital didn't know what it was. Initial effects of exposure were coughing, severe eye irritation, and a feeling of suffocation, burning in the respiratory tract, breathlessness, stomach pains, vomiting. People awakened by these symptoms fled away from the plant. Those who ran inhaled more than those who had a vehicle to ride. Owing to their height, children and other residents of shorter stature inhaled higher concentrations as the gas is twice as dense as air and therefore in an open environment falls to the ground.
Wow.
Thousands of people had died by the following morning.
Oh my God. So it was fast.
Fast. Fast. Immediately. As it rushed out from the plant into the town. Preliminary causes of death were choking, circulatory collapse, and pulmonary edema. Findings during autopsies revealed changes not only in the lungs, but also cerebral edema, tubular necrosis of the kidneys, fatty degeneration in the liver, and necrotizing enteritis, which is the inside version of necrotizing fasciitis, which is the disease that eats your skin away. So your body eats itself from the inside out.
That's unfortunate.
Incredibly. The stillbirth rate increased by up to 300%. Mortality rate by around 200%. And so many people died that they had to have mass funerals and cremations.
Wow.
It's heartbreaking. So, hold on. It makes me so sad. There was a photojournalist, Pablo Bartholomew, who was on commission with the press agency in Raffo, took an iconic color photograph of a burial titled The Bhopal Gas Disaster Girl, which we will post on the Instagram. Another photographer present took a black and white photo. The identity of the girl in the photo remains unknown. Both photos became symbolic of the suffering of victims in the Bhopal disaster, and Bartholomew's went on to win the 1984 World Press Photo of the Year.
Woo!
Woo! Isn't that great for Fantastic. Him to capture something so absolutely devastating and then get an award for it when we've had 10 years of shit going wrong at this factory and nobody put in any kind of safety implementations for the residents, for the workers. There was no policy. There was no procedure manual to follow. Anyway, within a few days, trees in the vicinity became barren. Bloated animal carcasses had to be disposed of. 170,000 people were treated at hospitals and temporary dispensaries. And 2,000 buffalo, goats, and other miscellaneous farm animals were collected and buried. Supplies, including food, became scarce owing to supplier safety fears, and fishing was prohibited until further notice, causing further supply shortages.
Wow. Oh, my gosh.
And today, that area still remains a toxic wasteland to this day. We're almost
35 years,
and it is still incredibly toxic.
So nobody lives there now.
Nobody lives there now. No, wow. You can't.
So it's just like a ghost town.
It's a ghost town. Like, and there was an initial push at the time for a lot of these like manufacturing plants to become unionized and to provide some basic level of safety for the workers. And that was met with a lot of resistance from higher up authorities. And really, this is the worst part. No true change came from this.
Ugh.
It's just a thing that happened. That was the worst industrial disaster.
And they were like, moving on.
And they're like, oh, well, that sucks.
Cryony.
So that is the Bhopal gas disaster.
How many people did you say died total?
Immediately or total?
Total.
Upwards of 30,000 died. But that doesn't include like the newborn fatalities, the stillborn, the long-term
effects.
Deaths.
Okay.
Yeah, so those are just people who died within the first few weeks of it. Not people who are still living with all of the really awful side effects that they still have.
Probably mentally and emotionally, too.
Oh, sure.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
Gross, right?
Yeah. I don't love it, but here we are. All right. Are you ready to hear something else completely horrible?
Yeah. Boy, am I.
All right. So our stories actually have a lot of parallels.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, we always do
this. I know. I was like, all right. So mine also takes place in 1984.
Whoa.
Yeah. And I am covering the San Ysidro. Oh, my God. I practiced
what?
That.
The
Ysidro.
What?
Ysidro.
Okay.
McDonald's Massacre.
I have no idea what that is.
Oh. At the time in 1984, it was the biggest mass shooting in the United States.
Oh, my God.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So my sources for this would be a documentary called 77 Minutes, directed by Charlie Min, the San Diego Police Museum.com, Wikipedia, Murderpedia, and My Favorite Murder Podcast. It's July 18th, 1984. It's a sunny day in San Ysidro. It's San... Ysidro. It's a lot easier to type it than it is to say
San Ysidro.
San Ysidro. It's Y-S-I-D-R-O. It's too many consonants in a row.
That was so many. My brain couldn't even process the letters that you said.
Yeah, right?
Okay.
I don't like words that start with Y.
No.
Like, that doesn't make sense to my brain.
San Ysidro Mountains.
Yeah. So it's a district in San Diego, and it sits directly north of the Mexican border. So just to give you, like, a geographical location.
Okay.
Alberto Leos was 16 years old and had a lot of friends. He was invited to go to the beach on July 18th, and even though he thought about it, something told him to not go into work that day. He decided to go into work, which was at the McDonald's in San Ysidro.
Listen to your gut.
Right. And he said it was one of those things that he was like, my parents didn't raise me to not go to work.
Oh.
Like, I was that kid that was very much like, I wanted to follow my, like, instinct and my gut and be like, yes, I want to go have a good time. But he was like, it's not worth my job. Like, he was 16. It was his first job.
That's hard.
Yeah. Neva Kane had just returned from her honeymoon. She was 22 years old and was the manager on duty at the McDonald's. Mateo Herrera and his best friend Keith Thomas were around 11 years old in 1984, and they did everything together. Mateo's parents, Ronald and Blythe, took the boys for a treat at McDonald's just before 4 p.m. on July 18th. James Huberty was 41 years old, and in 1984, he was unemployed, but he used to be a security guard. He and his wife had two daughters and went to the San Diego Zoo in the morning on July 18th. During the walk around the zoo, James told his wife that he believed that his life was effectively over. Mm. 3 days before, James had mentioned to Edna that he thought he needed mental health help. He called the San Diego Mental Health Center on July 17th. He was very calm on the phone, and the woman who answered the phone said that he should expect a call back from a professional within a few hours. However, due to his calm demeanor, the secretary categorized James' case as non-crisis.
Oof.
And she wrote down his last name incorrectly as Huberty instead of Huberty.
Oof. Oh, God.
Non-crisis calls get returned within 48 hours, not the same day.
Mm.
Like, I don't want to blame the secretary, but this is, like, Secretary 101. Like, you write your shit down right.
Right. Double-check your spelling.
Yeah. And you tell people correctly.
Right.
You know? That's your whole job.
This is just... not a great example of excellent customer service, honestly. But okay.
But what happened next was not her fault.
Okay.
So after the Hubertys came back from the zoo, Edna went to lay down and read, and the girls were playing in their rooms. James changed clothes, went to the bedroom, looked at his wife, and said, I want to kiss you goodbye. Ooh. She kissed him and asked him where he was going, and he said, I'm going hunting. Hunting for humans.
Ew, he said that to her?
Yep.
She wasn't like...
The fuck?
Oh, wait.
Right. So I believe I'm going to get into like some bullets on like what James was like before, but he was like a gun freak. He never smiled. He was not a joyous, happy man.
Ooh.
There was a lot of abuse in the family.
Ooh.
He had talked about suicide before and had like a lot of mental health issues. And I think Etna probably was just numb to it.
Desensitized.
Yeah.
Ugh.
So he left. He walked past one of his daughters on the way out and said, goodbye, I won't be back.
Yep. Bye, Dad.
Cool.
All right, awesome.
Like, fuck you, dude.
Right, honestly.
Right. Like, I think she was probably like 9 or 11 or something.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
Like, she was little. So annoying.
Ugh.
James left his apartment with a 9mm Browning HP semi-automatic pistol, a 9mm Uzi carbine,
ooh,
a Winchester 1200 12-gauge pump action shotgun,
Jesus,
a box and a cloth bag with filled with hundreds of rounds of ammunition for each weapon. So 3 weapons with ammos for each one.
Listen, you're not going hunting with an Uzi.
No!
No! You're going to annihilate that deer. You're not going to have any meat to bring home to the butcher.
Like, congratulations. This is like a bomb going off under your deer.
Thank you.
So he drove down the street to the very crowded McDonald's. The restaurant was only a half a block from his apartment.
Ooh.
Some witnesses said that he drove down the street and then turned around, and it seemed like he didn't have a location in mind when he settled on the McDonald's. He just like pulled in.
Aimlessly?
Yeah, he just wanted to get to the place that was going to have the most casualties.
Mm. McDonald's in the mid-80s were like a pretty poppin' place.
Yes. So this McDonald's was one of the busiest around. The community had a lot of children and families. And families often came to play in the playground and play set. There were about 45 people inside the McDonald's when James Huberty walked inside at 3:56 p.m.
It was a play place McDonald's?
Yes. Oh. With a playground outside.
Oh.
So the location of this is important because it is right on top of the American-Mexican border. So there was a lot of people who would, like, go stop at the McDonald's either before they went through border control or after they went through border control as, like, a snack.
Imagine when you could, like, imagine when you could just come and go through Mexico, easy peasy, lemon squeezy. It's like going to Canada.
Right.
Yeah.
No thanks.
A dream.
Yeah. No thanks to today's crazy insane.
Right. That is how exactly you should be.
Uh-huh.
That's how you should go to Mexico.
Yeah.
Just easy peasy, lemon squeezy.
Stop for McDonald's on the way.
Yeah. They should have, like, a McDonald's in the middle.
Yeah. So, very, very busy area.
Okay, got it.
Didn't
mean to sidetrack.
No, you're good. John Arnold is a 16-year-old employee working behind the counter. He was working when he heard someone say, "John, that guy's gonna shoot you." And he looked up, and James Huberty had his gun pointed at John, and he fired the weapon, but it misfired.
Ooh.
As Huberty inspected the gun, Neva Kane, the woman that got back from her honeymoon, she was the manager. She was the store manager. This baby angel was 22 years old.
Oh, sweet.
It was a McDonald's. Everybody who worked there was a, like, young adult teen.
Yeah. She's probably the oldest one there by a long shot.
Uh-huh. Yep. So she came around to see what was going on, and Huberty shot the shotgun towards the ceiling and then aimed and shot Neva below her left eye. She died moments later.
Oh.
Then he fired at John Arnold and hit him in the chest and arm, wounding him. Huberty yelled for everyone to get on the ground and started ranting about everyone in the restaurant being swine, Vietnamese assholes.
What?
A lot of people, like, look at this and say...
was he a vet?
Like, that he was a vet. Like, obviously, like, that must have been, like, the trigger, but he wasn't. He never served in any branch of the military.
Just propaganda?
Yeah.
That he got brainwashed by?
I think that he... truly just thought that that would be scary.
Oh, for the people?
For the people.
Ew.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so much grosser.
Yeah, no, I don't think that he was brainwashed by anything. I think that he just wanted to create as much unrest and uneasiness. In the people as he could.
What a fucking monster.
Yep. He said that he had killed 1,000 people before and he would kill 1,000 more. At this point, a 25-year-old man named Victor Rivera stood up and tried to talk Huberty down and asked him not to hurt anyone else. Huberty immediately started shooting at Victor, who died immediately.
Ugh.
I think he, like, shot him, like, 14 times or something.
Christ.
Yeah.
Almighty.
Huberty turned his attention to a group of women and children who were huddled together. I believe there were 6 people, and he killed all of them. A pregnant 18-year-old woman was shot 48 times with an Uzi. Huberty turned his gun on Ronald, Blythe, Mateo, and Keith.
Mm.
Blythe had her son Mateo on her side and tried to shield him, but ultimately Huberty killed both of them. Ronald was successful in saving Keith's life.
A Keith.
A good Keith.
A second good Keith.
Oh my God, it's full circle.
I know.
Ronald shielded him and was shot 6 times, but survived. Keith was shot multiple times also, but he also survived. I know.
My man, Keith.
No, thank God for the Ronald.
I know.
Like, shielding that little boy. Oh, God. All right. So in all this death, only a couple of minutes had passed and the first calls to emergency services were received at 4 p.m. And in another unfortunate miscommunication from the police department, they were directed to the wrong McDonald's.
I hope nobody's keeping tally at this point.
Oh, I hope they are. So the police were directed toward a McDonald's 2 miles down the street. So there was East San Ysidro Boulevard and West. And so they were directed to the wrong, like, direction.
Do your job better.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whoever took that call.
Yeah. And they were just told that there was a young girl that had been shot at the McDonald's and she was being carried next door to the post office. There was no additional details. It was just a girl was shot at McDonald's. She's going to the post office next door. So they did not know what they were going into.
Oh my God.
Did not know. So.
Well, they would have. Somebody. It just dawned on me that they didn't have cell phones.
Nope.
Somebody had to find a freaking landline. Okay. I get it.
Yeah. Miguel Rosario arrived on the scene. He was the first responding officer and he parked at the post office because that's where he was told to go. And he realized that something was going on at the McDonald's because there were people hiding in the bushes staring at the McDonald's in terror. Huberty then saw Rosario and came out of the restaurant to shoot at him. Rosario was successful in hiding behind a truck and called for pickup or backup. And you can hear that phone call to like the dispatcher, and he's like, I need immediate help, level 10, SOS, I'm in deep trouble here.
Mm.
And in our current climate, like, we don't think that police need to be any more armed than they currently are. They do enough damage, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
But this guy was like, I had a 38, and he had an Uzi.
Right.
I was outgunned.
Easily.
Could not even put up a fight if I wanted to.
Mm-mm.
So he hid behind the truck until backup came. Three 11-year-old boys were riding their bikes from the donut shop next door and going toward the McDonald's.
Turn around!
Yes, yeah, so someone yelled at them to warn them, and they all stopped and looked, and he shot all three of them.
Oh, my. Ew. Yeah. Oh, God.
Huberty opened fired. Omar Hernandez, David Delgado, and Joshua Coleman were all shot. Joshua was hit in the arm and turned to look back at his friends who died shortly after. Joshua survived the attack by playing dead.
Oh, God. Sweet baby angel.
Right. So there was a couple that was coming into the restaurant at this point, and Huberty was back inside, and it was an elderly couple, and the man was opening the door for his wife, and so his wife went into the restaurant first, and he shot her, and she died immediately. And then the man was like kneeling, like holding his wife and swearing at Huberty, and Huberty looked at him and said "fuck you" and pulled the trigger and killed him.
Oh my God!
I told you it's bad.
Ew.
Finally, the backup Miguel Rosario requested had arrived, and they shut down 6 blocks and set up a command post 2 blocks away. The police believe that there could have been more than one shooter because of all the different kinds of ammo that were outside.
Sure.
Like, reasonable.
Yeah.
Deduction.
A fair thought process. Right. Yeah.
And because he had been shooting so much, he had shot the windows, which are tempered glass. So they all look spiderwebbed.
You sure.
So you can't see in the
You can't restaurant. Tell where the shooter is, how many shooters, where nope. the bullets are coming from.
Nope. So they didn't have a like Clear enough information to enter the building.
Oh my God.
I
can't believe that people are still walking in. Like, y'all can set up a perimeter.
They did at this point. Okay. So nobody else came once the SWAT team got there and set up their perimeter. But until the backup came, people were just walking into the McDonald's.
Oh my fucking...
I know.
Woo!
Yep.
Okay.
Soon after the local police department showed up and shut everything down, SWAT arrived on the scene as well. Around 5 p.m., the gunfire seemed to have slowed. One person was able to escape from the back of the restaurant and give the police valuable information. It was one shooter, no hostages. All officers in SWAT were given the green light to kill Huberty on site if they had a clean shot.
Thank God.
For sure. Huberty was clearly out of his damn mind, but one especially heinous action that he did was carry a portable radio with him during the shooting. And witnesses originally thought that he was going to be listening to, like, updates for police, like, how close the police are.
Mm-hmm.
But he turned it to a music station and continued to kill people.
What, just jamming out?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Throw away the whole man. So Huberty went back into the kitchen to look for more people who were back there. He found six employees and ended up killing three young women and critically wounding 17-year-old Albert Leos. Four other employees and a female customer hid inside the basement utility room, and they were later joined by Leos, who had crawled to the utility room after being shot five times.
Oh my God.
He lost so much blood, and he was tourniqueting mm-hmm. his wounds with his shoelaces.
Oh my God.
To keep the blood flow.
Bleeding out.
At 5:17 p.m., Huberty was sitting on the service counter and then got up and walked toward the drive-thru window. A 27-year-old SWAT officer named Charles Foster took his shot and fatally killed Huberty.
Good job, buddy.
Good job.
Good job.
I know. I feel like they never get named.
No, they should.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The entire ordeal lasted 77 minutes.
Holy God.
77
minutes. That is so long.
Minutes. Uh-uh.
77? That is far. Like, you couldn't get a grapple on that situation.
My anxiety would kill me first.
Oh, yeah. For sure. Yeah,
I mean, if I was at minute 60, my anxiety would be like, you're dying, like, I'm killing you to put you out of your misery.
You would lose consciousness.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
You would. Your body has, like, a master override to prevent your brain
right.
from enduring a lot of physical or mental trauma.
That's true.
Which is something, I've been reading a lot about it recently, which it sounds dark, but it feels very comforting.
Uh-huh.
That there are ways that your body, like,
protects you
and cooperates mm-hmm. with itself to protect, like, the soul.
Yep.
From
That's wild.
Pain. It's a little beautiful.
Yeah.
But
thank God.
Yeah.
Thank God we have that.
Said, I hope that guy doesn't have it, and I hope he fucking suffered.
Yeah. Huberty had fired off a minimum of 257 rounds.
Holy God.
He killed 20 people and injured 20 more. The police originally said that most of the killings happened within minutes of the shooting, but survivors wholeheartedly and loudly disagree, saying that people were still being murdered at 40 minutes in.
Oh, my God. The police don't want that out.
No.
Saying that they floundered around for so fucking long.
Yep. Yeah. The documentary 77 Minutes I really, really enjoyed. I do think that the director and interviewer led his interviewees a little bit in his questioning.
Okay.
And he really, really paints the police department in a really horrible light, which, like, I'm not saying isn't true, but that is a huge narrative of this documentary is that the police department messed up, and they did. I got about probably...
You're trying to be Switzerland right now.
Yeah. I got about three quarters of the way through the documentary before it got really colored in the wrong direction. Not in the wrong direction. In, like, one direction.
Yeah.
One very biased
okay.
perspective. But it's still a fantastic documentary.
Okay.
And in the documentary, the director makes a point of this whole documentary is about the survivors. Mm-hmm. It's their stories. It's what happened on that day to them and how it's carved and shaped their lives. He never once says the name James Huberty.
Good.
Which I was like, good for you.
I love that. It's not about him.
Right. I'm going to keep saying his name.
But. I want to know what the longest, like, is that the longest duration that a mass shooting has? I'm sure not for, like, a hostage type situation, but there weren't hostages here.
Yeah.
Like a mass shooting.
I don't know. I know it's a very long time, and that's what makes this one still, like, a huge topic of conversation today is that it lasted so long.
God. Sickening.
Right.
It's fucking sickening.
So immediately after the shooting, McDonald's suspended all advertising for days following the massacre. In an act of solidarity, Burger King followed suit and also suspended all of their advertising.
Aw, look at BK Lounge and MacDose coming together.
I don't know why that got me. Like, I, like, got, like, teary-eyed when I read that. And I was like, I don't know if it's because, like, I view corporate America being so cold-hearted.
Yeah, which
they are.
And
it's all about money.
Yeah.
But Burger King didn't have to do that.
No.
It was just a kind gesture.
Listen, I've said it before. I have not said this before. But I'll probably say it again.
We'll say it
Burger
after
Burger King is a sweet, wholesome little fast food chain. I love Burger King. I do. I will love it until I die.
Don't ever eat at Burger King.
I fucking love Burger King. They have the best onion rings, period.
I don't normally get onion rings either. Like, I love onion rings. I just don't ever order them at fast food. Like, I would like a Bloomin' Onion from, like, Outback.
Ooh, that sounds really good. I wonder if you can make... I bet we can make a Bloomin' Onion in the air fryer.
Yeah, I bet we can. Yeah. We should do that.
Okay.
So, because there were so many funerals, many of them had to be held back-to-back at the San Ysidro Civic Center.
Ooh.
Edna, Huberty, and their daughters were left in the wake of horror. James had been abusive to all of them in the past, and there were a lot of people who worked with James in the past said that they were not surprised to hear that it had been James when they heard about the mass shooting.
Great guy.
Edna and the girls received death threats for weeks following the massacre.
Ugh. Like, they were also...
Before you feel too bad for them.
Okay.
Let me tell you what Edna did. This woman filed a lawsuit against McDonald's.
What? Why?
For her husband and her husband's former employer, Babak and Cox, this civil suit, seeking $5 million in damages.
For fucking why?
Asserted that her husband's murder spree had been triggered by a combination of poor diet and her husband's working around highly poisonous metals without adequate protection over the course of many years.
I'm sorry. I don't fucking buy that. I don't fucking buy that for a second. I don't.
No.
No. No one has ever eaten too many McChickens.
And then got on a shooting spree.
Right.
No.
No.
Yeah. So obviously she lost.
All right. Fine. I don't feel bad for her. I do feel bad for the children.
Yes. I believe they are or were kind of in witness protection. Like, they've all changed their names and have moved away. And
they shouldn't have to carry that around.
No. Yeah. McDonald's did create a $1 million survivors fund, and although there was a lot of protesting and hubbub from the other survivors, Edna got the first payout.
She did?
Mm-hmm. Eh. The McDonald's was demolished on September 26th, 1984, and the land sold to the city with the understanding that no restaurant will be built in its place. There is a memorial of 20 hexagon columns. Each column is a different height to represent the span of ages and victims. The youngest victim was 8-month-old baby who was shot in the back.
Oh, God.
Yep. Yep. So horrible.
Okay.
And a 76-year-old gentleman who was walking into the restaurant with his wife. And now I will read you a list of victims to remember them.
Okay.
I apologize for my terrible accent because this is... in the geographic location. Most of these are not names that I'm familiar with, so we'll get through it. Elsa Herlinda Barboa Faro was 19. Neva Denise Kane was 22. Michelle Diane Carnacross was 18. Maria Elena Colmenero Silva was 19. Gloria Lopez Gonzalez was 22. Blythe Reagan Herrera was 31. Mateo Herrera was 11. Paulina Aquino Lopez was 21. Margarita Padilla was 18. Claudia Perez was 9. Jose Ruben Alonzo Perez was 19. Carlos Reyes was 8 months old. Jackie Lynn Wright Reyes was 18. Victor Maximilian Rivera was 25. Aris Delcy Vuelvas Vargas was 31. Hugo Luis Vasquez Vasquez was 45. Lawrence Herman Versluis was 62. David Flores Delgado was 11. Omar Alonso Hernandez was 11. Miguel Victoria Ulloa was 74. And Adia Velasquez Victoria was 69 years old. And that is the very horrible story of the McDonald's massacre.
I'm sick. And I need a minute to myself to process the sheer vastness of how horrible people can be.
Absolutely. Those people had no idea. They didn't do anything to deserve anything that happened to them that day. And because it was in 84, there's a lot of photographs. And I will warn you, the documentary is graphic. Okay. There is, like, the police crime scene footage. There's a lot on there that I would... give you a little bit of a graphic trigger warning on.
I'll probably just hold off on that for the time being.
Yeah, maybe don't.
Yeah.
But.
Thanks for listening.
We hope you have a really good day. Don't forget about sending us your bright, shiny spots. Feel free to follow us on Instagram or Facebook, Twitter someday. And we really, really appreciate you.
Love you a lot.
Love you a lot. Goodbye.
Bye.